Wynne had given him had a dark look in its ghastly green eyes that didn't bode much better. Julian had braced himself for a lurching plunge upward, but when Gwen gave the order, the horse simply glided up into the air like a toy lifted on a string. Julian gasped out loud with a shock of it. He found his hands plunging into the horse's mane, gripping hard as the others shot up into the air around him, Christina, Gwen, Emma, Mark, and Kieran. For a moment they hovered, shadows under the moonlight. Then the horses shot forward. The sky blurred above them, the stars turning to streaks of shimmering, multicolored paint. Julian realized he was grinning, truly grinning, the way he rarely had since he was a child. He couldn't help it. Buried in everyone's soul, he thought, as they spun forward through the night, must be the yearning desire to fly. And not the way mundanes did, trapped inside a metal tube. Like this, exploding up through clouds as soft as down, the wind caressing your skin. He glanced over at Emma. She was leaning down over her horse's mane, long legs curved around its sides, her brilliant hair flying like a banner. Behind her rode Christina, who had her hands in the air and was shrieking with happiness.
"Emma!" she shouted. "Emma, look! No hands!"
Emma glanced back and laughed aloud. Mark, who rode Windspear with an air of familiarity, Kieran clinging to his belt with one hand, was not amused.
"Use your hands," he yelled. "Christina, it's not a roller coaster."
"Nephilim are insane," shouted Kieran, pushing his wildly blowing hair out of his face. Christina just laughed, and Emma looked at her with a wide smile, her eyes glowing like the stars overhead, which turned to the silver-white stars of the mundane world. Shadows loomed up in front of them, white and black and blue. The cliffs of Dover, Julian thought, and felt an ache inside that it might be over so quickly. He turned his head and looked at his brother. Mark sat astride Windspear as if he'd been born on the horse's back. The wind tore his pale hair, revealing his sharply pointed ears. He was smiling, too, a calm and secret smile, the smile of someone doing what they loved. Far below them, the world spun by, a patchwork of silvery black fields, shadowy hills, and luminous, winding rivers. It was beautiful, but Julian could not take his eyes off his brother. "So this is the Wild Hunt," he thought. "This freedom, this expanse, this ferocity of joy." For the first time, he understood how and why Mark's choice to stay with his family might not have been an easy one. For the first time, he thought in wonder of how much his brother must love him after all, to have given up the sky for his sake. Part 2. Thule. Chapter 15. Friends Long Given. Kid had never thought he'd set foot in one Shadow Hunter Institute. Now he had eaten and slept in two. If this kept up, it was going to become a habit. The London Institute was exactly the way he would have imagined it, if he'd ever been asked to imagine it, which he admittedly hadn't. Housed in a massive old stone church, it lacked the glossy modernity of its Los Angeles counterpart. It looked as if it hadn't been renovated for 80 years. The rooms were painted in Edwardian pastels, which had faded over the decades into soft and muddied colors. The hot water was irregular, the beds were lumpy, and dust limned the surfaces of most of the furniture. It sounded, from bits and snatches Kit had overheard, as if the London Institute had once had many more people in it. It had been attacked by Sebastian Morgenstern during the Dark War, and most of the former inhabitants had never returned. The head of the Institute looked nearly as ancient as the building. Her name was Evelyn Highsmith. Kit got the sense that the Highsmiths were a big deal in the Shadowhunter Society, though not as big of a deal as Herondale's. Evelyn was a tall, imperious, white-haired woman in her 80s, who wore long 1940s-style dresses, carried a silver-headed walking stick, and sometimes talked to people who weren't there. Only one other person seemed to live in the Institute, Evelyn's maid, Bridget, who was just as ancient as her mistress. She had bright dyed red hair and 1,000 fine wrinkles. She was always popping up in unexpected places, which was inconvenient for Kit, who was once again on the lookout for anything he might steal. It wasn't a quest that was going well. Most of what appeared valuable was furniture, and he couldn't imagine how he was supposed to creep away from the Institute carrying a sideboard. The weapons were carefully locked away. He didn't know how to sell candlesticks on the street, and though there were valuable first editions of books in the enormous library, most of them had been scribbled in by some idiot named Will H. The dining room door opened, and Diana came in. She was favoring one arm. Kit had found out that some Shadowhunter injuries, especially those that involved demon poison or ichor, healed slowly despite runes. Libby perked up at the sight of her tutor. The family had gathered for dinner, which was served at a long table in a massive Victorian dining room. Angels had once been painted on the ceiling, but they had long ago been nearly completely covered by dust and the stains of old burns. "Did you hear anything from Alec and Magnus?" Diana shook her head, taking the seat opposite Livy. Livy wore a blue dress that looked like it had been stolen from the set of a BBC period piece. Though they'd fled the L.A. Institute with none of their belongings, it turned out there were years' worth of clothes stored in London, though none of them looked as if they'd been purchased after 1940. Evelyn, Kit, and the Blackthorne family sat around the table in an odd assortment of clothes, tie and kit in trousers and long-sleeved shirts, Tavi in a striped cotton shirt and shorts, and Drusilla in a black velvet gown that had delighted her with its gothic appeal. Diana had rejected all the garments and simply hand-washed her own jeans and shirt. "What about the Clave?" said Ty. "Have you talked to the Clave?" "Are they ever useful?" Kit muttered under his breath. He didn't think anyone had heard him, but someone must have, because Evelyn burst out laughing. "Oh, Jessamine," she said to no one, "come now, 'tisn't in good taste at all." The Blackthorns all raised their eyebrows at each other. No one commented, though, because Bridget had appeared from the kitchen, carrying steaming plates of meat and vegetables, both of which had been boiled to the point of tastelessness.
"I just don't see why we can't go home," Drew said glumly. "If the Centaurians defeated all the sea demons, like they said..."
"It doesn't mean Malcolm won't come back," said Diana. "And it's Blackthorn blood he wants. You're staying within these walls, and that's final." Kit had passed out during the horrible thing they called the portal journey, the terrible whirl through absolutely icy nothingness. So he missed the scene that must have occurred when they appeared in the London Institute, minus Arthur, and Diana had explained they were there to stay. Diana had contacted the Clave to tell them about Malcolm's threats, but Zara had been there first. Apparently, she'd assured the Council that the Centaurians had it all under control, and that they were more than a match for Malcolm and his army, and the Clave had been only too happy to take her word for it. And, as if Zara's assurance had in fact effected a miracle, Malcolm didn't turn up again, and no demons visited the western seaboard. 2 days had passed, and there had been no news of disaster.
"I hate Zara and Manuel being in the Institute without us there to watch them," said Livy, throwing her fork down. "The longer they're there, the better claim they have for the cohort taking it over."
"Ridiculous," said Evelyn. "Arthur runs the Institute. Don't be paranoid, girl." She pronounced it girl.
Libby flinched. Though everyone, even Drew and Tavi, had finally been brought up to speed on the situation, including Arthur's illness and the facts about where Julian and the others really were, it had been decided it was better for Evelyn not to know. She wasn't an ally. There was no reason she'd side with them, though she seemed patently uninterested in council politics. In fact, most of the time she didn't seem to be listening to them at all.
"According to Zara, Arthur's been locked in his office with the door shut since we left," said Diana.
"I would be, too, if I had to put up with Zara," said Drew.
"I still don't see why Arthur didn't come with you," sniffed Evelyn. "He used to live in this Institute. You think he wouldn't mind paying a visit?"
"Look on the bright side, Livy," Diana said. "When Julian and the others return from where they are, they are most likely to go straight to Los Angeles. Would you want them to find an empty institute? Libby poked at her food and said nothing. She looked pale and drawn, purple shadows under her eyes. Kit had gone down the corridor the night they'd arrived in London, wondering if she wanted to see him. But he'd heard her crying through her door when he put his hand on the knob. He'd turned around and left, a strange pinching feeling in his chest. No one crying like that wanted anyone to come near them, especially not someone like him. He got the same pinching feeling when he looked across the table at Ty and remembered how the other boy had healed his hand. How cool Ty's skin had been against his. Ty was tense in his own way. The move to the London Institute had constituted a major disruption in his daily routine, and it was clearly bothering him. He spent a lot of time in the training room, which was almost identical in layout to its Los Angeles counterpart. Sometimes, when he was especially stressed, Livy would take his hands in hers and rub them matter-of-factly. The pressure seemed to ground him. Still, at the moment, Ty was tense and distracted, as if he'd folded in on himself somehow. "We could go to Baker Street," Kit said, without even knowing he was going to say it. "We are in London." Ty looked up at that, his gray eyes aglow. He had shoved his food away. Livy had told Kit that Ty took a long time to warm up to new foods and new flavors. For the moment, he was almost solely eating potatoes. "To 221B Baker Street?" "When everything with Malcolm is cleared up," Diana interrupted. "No Blackthorns out of the Institute until then, and no Herondales either. I don't like the way Malcolm glared at you, Kit." She stood up. "I'll be in the parlor. I need to send a fire message." As the door closed behind her, Tavi, who was staring at the air next to his chair in a way Kit found frankly alarming, giggled. They all turned to look in surprise. The youngest Blackthorn hadn't been laughing much lately. He supposed he didn't blame the kid. Julian was all Tavi had in the way of a father. Kit knew what missing your father was like, and he wasn't 7 years old.
"Jesse!"
Evelyn scolded, and for a moment Kit actually looked around as if the person she was addressing was in the room with them.
"Leave the child alone. He doesn't even know you."
She glanced around the table.
"Everyone thinks they're good with children. Few know when they're not."
She took a bite of carrot.
"I am not," she said around the food. "I have never been able to stand children."
Kit rolled his eyes. Tavi looked at Evelyn as if he was considering throwing a plate at her.
"You might as well take Tavi to bed, Drew," said Libby hastily. "I think we're done with dinner here."
"Sure, why not? It's not like I didn't find clothes for him this morning, or put him to bed last night. Might as well be a servant," Drew snapped, and snatched Tavi out of his chair and stalked out of the room, dragging her younger brother behind her. Libby put her head into her hands. Ty looked over at her and said, "You don't have to take care of everyone, you know." Livy sniffled and looked sideways at her twin.
"It's just, without Jules here, I'm the oldest. By a few minutes, anyway."
"Diana's the oldest," said Ty. Nobody mentioned Evelyn, who had placed a pair of spectacles on her nose and was now reading a newspaper.
"But she's got so much more to do than look after us. I mean, look after the little things," said Livy. "I never really thought about it before. All the stuff Julian does for us. But it's so much. He always holds it together and takes care of us, and I don't even get how."
There was a sound like an explosion overhead. Ty's face drained. It was clear he was hearing a noise he'd heard before. "Livy," said Ty, "the Accords Hall." The noise sounded less like an explosion now and more like thunder. A rushing thunder that was taking over the sky. A sound like clouds being ripped apart as if cloth were tearing. Drew burst into the room, Tavi just behind her.
"It's them," she said. "You won't believe it, but you have to come, quickly. I saw them flying. I went up to the roof."
"Who?" Livy was on her feet. They all were, except Evelyn, who was still reading the paper.
"Who's on the roof, Drew?"
Drew swept Tavi up into her arms.
"Everyone,"
she said, her eyes shining. The roof of the Institute was shingle, stretching out wide and flat to a waist-high iron-wrought railing. The finials of the railings were tipped with iron lilies. In the distance, Kit could see the glimmering dome of St. Paul's, familiar from 1,000 movies and TV shows. The clouds were heavy, iron-colored, surrounding the top of the Institute like clouds around a mountain. Kit could barely see down to the streets below. The air was acrid with summer thunder. They had all spilled out into the roof, everyone but Evelyn and Bridget. Diana was there, her arm carefully cradled. Ty's gray eyes were fixed on the sky.
There, Drew said, pointing. Do you see?
As Kit stared, the glamour peeled away. Suddenly it was as if a painting or a movie had come to life. Only movies didn't give you this visceral tangle of wonder and fear. Movies didn't give you the smell of magic in the air, crackling like lightning, or the shadows cast by a host of impossibly soaring creatures against the sky above it. They didn't give you starlight on a girl's blonde hair as she slid, shrieking in excitement and happiness, from the back of a flying horse and landed on a roof in London. They didn't give you the look on the Blackthorns' faces as they saw their brothers and friends coming back to them. Livy leapt at Julian, hurling her arms around his neck. Mark flung himself from his horse and half-tumbled down to find himself being hugged tightly by Drew and Tavi. Ty came more quietly, but with the same incandescent happiness on his face. He waited for Livy to be done nearly strangling her brother and then stepped in to take Julian's hands. And Julian, who Kit had always thought of as an almost frightening model of control and distance, grabbed his brother and yanked him close, his hands twisting in the back of Ty's shirt. His eyes were shut, and Kit had to look away from the expression on his face. He had never had anyone but his father, and he was sure beyond any words that his father had never loved him like that. Mark came up to his brothers then, and Ty turned to look at him. Kit heard him say,
"I wasn't sure you would come back."
Mark laid his hand on his brother's shoulder and spoke gruffly.
"I'll always come back to you, Tiberius. I am sorry if I ever led you to believe anything else."
There were two other arrivals as well among the Blackthorns, who Kit didn't recognize. A gorgeously scowling boy with blue-black hair that waved around his angular face, and a wide-shouldered, massive man wearing an alarming helmet with carved antlers protruding from either side. Both of them sat astride their horses silently without dismounting, a fairy escort perhaps to keep the others safe. But how had the Blackthorns and Emma managed to secure a favor like that? Then again, if anyone could manage to secure such a thing, it would be Julian Blackthorn. As Kit's father used to say about various criminals, Julian was the kind of person who could descend into hell and come out with the devil himself owing him a favor. Diana was hugging Emma and then Christina, tears shining on her face. Feeling awkwardly out of place at the reunion, Kit made his way to the edge of the railing. The clouds had cleared away, and he could see Millennium Bridge from here, lit up like rainbow colors. A train rattled over another bridge, casting its reflection into the water.
"Who are you?" said a voice at his elbow.
Kit startled and turned around. It was one of the two fairies he had noticed earlier, the scowling one. His dark hair, up close, looked less black than like a mixture of deep greens and blues. He brushed a bit of it away from his face, frowning. He had a full, slightly uneven mouth, but far more interesting were his eyes. Like Mark's, they were two different colors. One was the silver of a polished shield. The other was a black so dark his pupil was barely visible.
"Kit," said Kit.
The boy with the ocean hair nodded.
"I'm Kieran," he said. "Kieran Hunter."
Hunter wasn't a real sort of fairy name, Kit knew. Fairies didn't generally give their true names, as names held power. Hunter just denoted what he was, the way Nixies called themselves waterborn. Kieran was of the wild hunt.
"Huh,"
said Kit, thinking of the cold piece.
"Are you a prisoner?"
"No," said the fairy. "I'm Mark's lover."
Oh, Kit thought. The person he went into Fairy to save. He tried to stifle a look of amusement at the way fairies talked. Intellectually, he knew the word lover was part of traditional speech, but he couldn't help it. He was from Los Angeles, and as far as he was concerned, Kieran had just said, "Hello, I have sex with Mark Blackthorne. What about you?" "I thought Mark was dating Emma," Kit said. Kieran looked confused. A few of the curls of his hair seemed to darken, or perhaps it was a trick of the light. "I think you must be mistaken," he said. Kit raised an eyebrow. How close was this guy actually to Mark, after all? Maybe they'd just had a meaningless fling. Though why Mark would then have dragged half his family to Ferry to save him was a mystery. Before he could say anything, Kieran turned his head, his attention diverted. "That must be the lovely Diana," he said, gesturing toward the Blackthorn's tutor. "Gwyn was most enraptured with her." "Gwyn's the big guy, antler helmet?" said Kit. Kieran nodded, watching as Gwyn dismounted his horse to speak with Diana, who looked quite tiny against his bulk, though she was a tall woman.
"Providence has brought us together again," Gwyn said.
"I don't believe in Providence," said Diana. She looked awkward, a little alarmed. She was holding her injured arm close to her. "Or an interventionist heaven."
"There are more things in heaven and earth," said Gwyn, "than are dreamt of in your philosophy."
Kit snorted. Diana looked flabbergasted. "Are you quoting Shakespeare?" she said. "I would have thought at least it would have been A Midsummer Night's Dream."
"Fairies can't stand A Midsummer Night's Dream," muttered Kieran. "Gets everything wrong."
Gwyn's lips twitched at the corners.
"Speaking of dreams," he said, "you have been in mine, and often."
Diana looked stunned. The Blackthorns had quieted their loud reunion and were watching her and Gwyn with unabashed curiosity. Julian was even smiling a little. He was holding Tavi, who had his arms hooked around his brother's neck like a clinging koala.
"I would that you would meet me, formally, that I might court you," said Gwyn.
His large hands moved aimlessly at his sides, and Kit realized with a shock that he was nervous. This big, muscled man, the leader of the wild hunt, nervous.
"We could together slay a frost giant, or devour a deer."
"I don't want either of those things," said Diana after a moment. Gwyn looked crestfallen. "But I will go out with you," she said, blushing. "Preferably to a nice restaurant. Bring flowers, and not the helmet." The Blackthorns burst into giggling applause. Kit leaned against the wall with Kieran, who was shaking his head in bemusement.
"And thus was the proud leader of the hunt felled by love," he said. "I hope there will be a ballad about it some day."
Kit watched Gwyn, who was ignoring the applause as he readied his horses to leave.
"You don't look like the other Blackthorns," said Kieran after a moment. "Your eyes are blue, but not like the ocean's blue, more of an ordinary sky."
Kit felt obscurely insulted.
"I am not a Blackthorn," he said.
"I'm a Herondale. Christopher Herondale."
He waited. The name Herondale seemed to produce an explosive reaction in most denizens of the supernatural world. The boy with the ocean hair, though, didn't bat an eye.
"Then what are you doing here, if you're not family?" he asked.
Kit shrugged.
"I don't know. I don't belong, that's for sure."
Kieran smiled a sideways fairy smile.
"That makes two of us."
They eventually gathered in the parlor, the warmest room in the house. Evelyn was already there, muttering by the fire burning in the grate. Even though it was late summer, London had a damp, chill edge to it. Bridget brought sandwiches, tuna and sweet corn, bacon and chicken, and the newcomers tucked into them as if they were wildly starving. Julian had to eat awkwardly with his left hand, balancing Tavi on his lap with the other. The parlor had aged better than a lot of the other rooms in the Institute. It had a cheerful, flowered wallpaper, only slightly discolored, and gorgeous antique furniture someone had clearly picked out with care. A lovely roll-top desk, a delicate escritoire,
plush velvet armchairs and sofas grouped around the fireplace. Even the fire screen was made of delicate wrought iron, patterned with wing-spread herons, and when the fire shone through it, the shadow of the birds was cast against the wall as if they were flying by. Kieran alone didn't seem thrilled with the sandwiches. He poked at them suspiciously and pulled them apart, eating only the tomatoes, while Julian explained what had happened in Faerie, their journey to the Unseelie court, the meeting with the queen, the blight on the Unseelie land. There were burned places, white as ash, like the surface of the moon, Mark said, eyes dark with distress. Kit tried his best to hang on to the story, but it was like trying to ride a roller coaster with faulty brakes. Phrases like scrying glass, Unseelie champion, and black volume of the dead kept hurling him off track. How much time passed for them? He whispered finally to Ty, who was wedged in beside him and Livy on a love seat too small for the three of them. It sounds like a few less days than passed for us, said Ty. Some time slippage, but not much. Christina's necklace seems to have worked. Kit whistled under his breath. And who's Annabelle? She was a Blackthorn, said Ty. She died, but Malcolm brought her back. From the dead? Kit said. That's necromancy. Malcolm was a necromancer, pointed out Ty. Shut up, Livy elbowed Kit, who was lost in thought. Necromancy wasn't just a forbidden art in the shadow market. It was a forbidden topic. The punishment for raising the dead was death. If the shadow hunters didn't catch you, other downworlders would, and the way you died would not be pretty. Bringing back the dead, Johnny Rook had always said, warped the fabric of life, the same way making humans immortal did. Invite in death, and death would stay. Could anyone bring back the dead and have it work? Kit had asked him once. Even the most powerful magician? God, Johnny had said after a long, long pause. God could do that. And those who raise the dead may think they are God. But soon enough, they will find out the lie they had believed.
The head of the Los Angeles Institute is dead?
Evelyn exclaimed, dropping the remains of her sandwich on a likely very expensive antique table. Kit didn't really blame her for her surprise. The Blackthorns didn't act like a family in grief over the death of a beloved uncle. Rather, they seemed stunned and puzzled. But then they had behaved around Arthur almost as if they were strangers. "Is that why he wanted to stay behind in Los Angeles?" Livy demanded, her cheeks flushed. "So he could sacrifice himself? For us?" "By the angel," Diana had her hand against her chest. "He hadn't replied to any of my messages, but that wasn't unusual. Still, for Zara not to notice." "Maybe she did, maybe she didn't," said Livy. "But it's better for her plans if he's out of the way." "What plans?" said Christina. "What do you mean, Zara's plans?" It was time for another long explanation, this time of things Kit already knew about. Evelyn had fallen asleep in front of the fireplace and was snoring. Kit wondered how much the silver top of her cane was worth. Was it real silver, or just plated? "By the angel," said Christina. When the explanation was done, Julian said nothing. Emma said something unprintable. Mark leaned forward, a flush on his cheeks. "Let me get this straight," he said. "Zara and her father want to run the Los Angeles Institute so they can push their anti-downworlder agenda. The new laws would likely apply to me and to Helen. Certainly to Magnus, Katerina, every downworlder we know, no matter how loyal." "I know of their group," said Diana. "They don't believe in loyal downworlders." "What is their group?" Emma asked. "The Cohort," said Diana. "They are a well-known faction of the Council. Like all groups who exist primarily to hate, they believe they speak for a silent majority, that everyone despises downworlders as they do. They believe opposition to the Cold Piece is moral cowardice, or at best, whining from those who feel inconvenienced by it." "Inconvenienced?" said Kieran. There was no expression in his voice, just the word hanging there in the room. "They are not intelligent," said Diana. "But they are loud and vicious. They have frightened many better people into silence. They do not number an institute head among them, but if they did..." "This is bad," Emma said. "Before, they would have had to prove Arthur wasn't fit to run an institute. Now he's dead. The spot's open. All they have to do is wait for the next council meeting and put their candidate forward." "And they're in a good place for it." Diana had risen to her feet and begun to pace. "The Clave is enormously impressed with Zara Dearborn. They believe she and her Centaurians beat back the sea demon threat on their own. The demons vanished because Malcolm died, again, and this time hopefully for good," said Libby furiously. "None of it is because of Zara. She's taking credit for what Arthur did."
"And there's nothing we can do about it," said Julian. "Not yet. They'll figure out Arthur is dead or missing soon enough. But even abandonment of his post would be cause to replace him.
And we can't be seen to know how or why he died. Because the only reason we do know is thanks to the Seelie Queen," said Emma in a low voice, eyeing the sleeping Evelyn.
"Annabelle is the key to our finding the Black Volume," said Julian. "We need to be the only ones looking for her right now. If the Clave finds her first, we'll never get the book to the Queen."
"When we agreed with the Queen's plan, though, we didn't know about the cohort," said Mark, looking troubled. "What if there isn't time to find the book before the cohort makes their move?"
"We'll just have to find the book faster," said Julian. "We can't face the Dearborns in an open council. What's Zara done wrong, according to the Clave? Arthur wasn't qualified to run the Institute. Many council members do hate downworlders. She wants to run an Institute so she could pass an evil law. She wouldn't be the first. She's not breaking the rules. We are."
Kit felt a faint shudder go up his spine. For a moment, Julian sounded like Kit's father.
"The world isn't the way you want it to be. It's the way it is."
"So we're just supposed to pretend we don't know what Zara's up to?" Emma frowned. "No," said Diana. "I'm going to Idris. I'm going to speak to the council." They all looked at her, wide-eyed, all except Julian, who didn't seem surprised, and Kieran, who was still glaring at his food. "What Zara is proposing would mean Gia's daughter would be married to one of the downworlders being registered. Gia knows what that would lead to. I know she'd meet with me. If I can reason with her..."
"She let the cold piece pass," said Kieran.
"She had no choice," said Diana. "If she'd had warning of what was coming, I'd like to think it would have turned out differently. This time, she'll have that warning. Besides, we have something to offer her now."
"That's right," said Julia, gesturing at Kieran. "The end of the cold peace. A fairy messenger from the Queen of Seelie."
Evelyn, who had been napping by the fire, bolted upright.
"That is enough," she glared daggers at Kieran. "I can accept a blackthorn into this house. Even one with a questionable bloodline, I will always accept a blackthorn. But a full-blood fairy, listening to the business of Nephilim? I will not allow it."
Kieran looked briefly startled. Then he rose to his feet. Mark began to rise too. Julian stayed exactly where he was.
"But Kieran is part of our plan."
"Stuff and nonsense. Bridget!"
she called, and the maid, who had clearly been lurking in the corridor, stuck her head into the room.
"Please lead this princeling to one of the spare bedrooms. I will have your word, fairy, that you will not depart it until you are allowed."
Kieran looked at Christina.
"What is your desire, my lady?"
Kit was baffled. Why was Kieran, a prince of the gentry, taking orders from Christina? She blushed.
"You don't need to swear you won't leave the room," she said. "I trust you."
"Do you?"
Emma said, sounding fascinated,
as Kieran gave a stiff bow and departed. Bridget's muttering could be heard by all as she led Kieran out of the room.
"Fairies in the Institute," she muttered. "Ghosts is one thing, warlocks is another, but never in all my born days."
Drusilla looked puzzled. Why is Kieran here? She said as soon as he was gone. I thought we hated him. Like, mostly hated him. I mean, he did save our lives, but he's still a jerk.
There was a murmur of voices. Kit remembered something he'd overheard Livy say to Drew a day or two ago. More pieces of the Kieran puzzle. Livy had been angry that Mark would go to Ferry to help someone who had hurt him. Had hurt Emma and Julian. Kit didn't know exactly what had happened, but it had clearly been bad. Emma moved to sit on the couch beside Christina. She'd arrived wearing a pale gossamer dress that looked like something Kit would have seen in the shadow market. It made her look delicate and graceful, but Kit remembered the steel in her, the way she'd sliced apart the praying mantis demon in his house with all the calm of a bride cutting slices of wedding cake. Julian was quietly listening to his family talk. Even though he wasn't looking at Emma, an almost visible energy crackled between them. Kit remembered the way Emma had said, "This isn't Julian's kind of place," to his father. One of the first things he'd heard her say in the market, and the way her voice had seemed to hug the syllables of his name. Parabatai was strange. So close, and yet it wasn't a marriage. Yet it was more than a best friendship. There was no real analog in the mundane world, and it drew him, the idea of it, of being connected to someone like that, the way all the dangerous and beautiful things of the Shadow Hunter world drew him. Maybe Ty. Julian stood up, setting Tavi down in an armchair. He stretched out his arms, cracking the sinews in his wrists. "The thing is, we need Kieran," he said. Evelyn snorted.
"Imagine needing a fairy lord," she said, "for anything."
Julian whispered something in Tavi's ear. A moment later, he was on his feet. "Miss Highsmith," he said, "my little brother is exhausted, but he says he doesn't know where his bedroom is. Can you show him?" Evelyn looked irritably between Julian to Tavi, who smiled angelically at her, showing off his dimples.
"Can't you escort the child?"
"I've only just arrived," said Julian. "I don't know where the room is." He added his own smile to Tavi's. Julian could radiate charm when he wanted to. Kit had nearly forgotten. Evelyn looked around to see if there were any volunteers to take over for her. No one moved. Finally, with a disgusted snort, she snapped her fingers at Tavi, said,
"Well, come on then, child,"
and stalked from the room with him in tow. Julian's smile turned crooked. Kit couldn't help the feeling that Julian had used Evelyn to get rid of Kieran, and Tavi to get rid of Evelyn, and done it so handily no one could ever prove it. If Julian ever wanted to turn his hand to cons and crime, Kit thought, he would have excelled at it. "We need Kieran to bargain with the Clave," said Julian, as if nothing had happened. "When we found him in Ferry, his father was about to have him killed. He escaped, but he'll never be safe as long as the Unseelie King sits on the throne." He ran his hands through his hair restlessly. Kit wondered how Julian kept it all in his head. Plans, plots, concealments, truths. "And the Queen wants the King off the throne," said Emma. "She's willing to help us replace him with Kieran's brother, but Kieran had to promise to convince him."
"Kieran's brother would be better than the king they have right now?" asked Drew.
"He would be better," Emma confirmed, "believe it or not." "Kieran will also testify in front of the council," said Julian. "He will bring the queen's message that she's willing to ally with us to defeat the king. He can confirm for the council what the king is doing in the Unseelie lands."
"But you could tell him that," said Kit.
"If we wanted to risk the wrath of the Clave for venturing into Ferry," Julian said. "Not to mention that while we might get out of that, there will be no forgiveness for having entered into a bargain with the Seelie Queen." Kit had to admit, Julian was right. He knew how much trouble the Blackthorns had nearly gotten in for bargaining with the Ferry convoy who had returned Mark to them. The Seelie Queen was a whole other level of forbidden. It was like getting a slap on the wrist for running a red light and then coming back the next day and blowing up the whole street.
"Kieran's your get-out-of-jail-free card," he said.
"It's not just about us," said Emma.
If the council will listen to him, it could end the cold peace. In fact, it would have to. They'll have to believe him. He can't lie. And if the queen is willing to fight the Unseelie king with the Clave, I don't think they'll be able to turn that down. Which means we have to keep Kieran safe, said Julian. We also have to do what we can not to antagonize him. Because he's doing this for Mark, said Drew. But Mark broke up with him, said Libby, and then looked around alarmed. Her ponytail brushed Kit's shoulder. Is that something I wasn't supposed to say? No, Mark said. It's the truth. But Kieran doesn't remember. When the Unseelie court tortured him, he lost some of his memories. He doesn't recall bringing the envoy to the Institute, or Emma and Julian being whipped, or what danger he put us all in with his haste and anger. He looked down at his intertwined hands, and he must not be told. But Emma, said Livy, are we supposed to pretend that she and Mark aren't... Kit leaned close to Ty. Ty smelled like ink and wool. I don't understand any of this. Neither do I, Ty whispered back. It's very complicated. Mark and I, Emma said, looking very steadily at Mark, we broke up. Kit wondered if Mark had known that. He wasn't able to hide the look of astonishment on his face. It just didn't work out, Emma went on. So it's all right, whatever Mark needs to do. They've broken up? Livy whispered. Ty shrugged, baffled. Livy had gone tense and was glancing from Emma to Mark, clearly worried. We have to let Kieran think he and Mark are still dating, said Ty, looking bewildered. Kit felt the whole thing was beyond him as well. But then Henry VIII had beheaded several of his wives for apparently governmental reasons. The personal, the political, and the romantic were often oddly entwined. Concealing things from Kieran isn't ideal, said Julian, hands in his pockets. And I hate to ask you guys to lie. Probably it's best to avoid the subject. But there's literally no other way to make sure he actually shows up in front of the Clave. Mark sat, running his fingers through his blonde hair in a distracted manner. Kit could hear him saying, I'm all right, it's fine, to Christina. He felt a surge of odd sympathy. Not for Mark, but for Kieran. Kieran, who didn't know that his boyfriend wasn't really his boyfriend. That he was sleeping in a house full of people who, however friendly they might seem, would lie to him to get something they needed. He thought of the coldness he'd seen in Julian back at the Shadow Market. Julian, who would sacrifice Kieran, and perhaps his own brother in a way, to get what he wanted. Even if it was a good thing to want. Even if it was the end to the cold peace. Kit looked at Julian, gazing at the parlor fire with fathomless eyes, and suspected there was more to it. That where Julian Blackthorne was concerned, there would always be more to it. Chapter 16. Past the Wanderer. Mark made his way toward Kieran's room, steeling himself to lie. Uneasiness and exhaustion had driven Mark from the parlor. The others, equally tired, were scattering to their own bedrooms. Christina had slipped away without Mark noticing, though he had felt her absence as a sort of pang in his chest after she was gone. Diana had decided to leave as soon as she could for Idris, and Julian and Emma had gone to see her off. Mark had been a little shocked by Emma's announcement that the pretense of their relationship was over. He knew what he'd said to her back in Ferry, and that she'd only done what he'd asked. Still, he felt slightly unmoored, alone, with no idea how to look in Kieran's eyes and tell him untruths. He didn't like lying. He hadn't done it in the hunt, and he felt uncomfortable with the rhythms of it. He wanted to talk about it with Christina, but he couldn't imagine she would want to hear about his complicated feelings for Kieran. Julian would be focused entirely on what was necessary and had to be done, no matter how painful. And now he could no longer talk to Emma. He hadn't realized how close their relationship, however false, had brought them in actual friendship. He wondered now if he would lose that too. And as for Kieran, Mark leaned his head against the wall next to Kieran's door. The corridors were papered in dull gold leaf, trailing vines and trellises, cool against his forehead.
Kieran was the person he could talk to least.
Not that banging his head against a wall was going to do any good. He straightened up and pushed the door open, quietly. The room they'd set aside for Kieran was far away from the rest of the sleeping quarters, up a small flight of stairs. A room that looked as if it had likely once been used for storage. Narrow, arched windows looked out over flat walls of buildings. There was a massive four-poster bed in the middle of the room, and an enormous wardrobe, though what they thought Kieran could possibly put in it, Mark had no idea. The coverlet had been pulled off the bed, and Kieran was nowhere to be seen. Mark felt a lurch of unease. Kieran had promised Christina he would stay, in his own way. If he had decided not to honor his pledge to Christina, there would be trouble. Mark sighed and closed his eyes. He felt stupid and vulnerable, standing in the middle of the room with his eyes shut. But he knew Kieran.
"Kier," he said, "I can't see anything. Come out and talk to me."
A moment later, there were fierce hands on his sides, lifting him, tossing him back on the bed. Kieran's weight pushed Mark down into the mattress. Mark opened his eyes and saw Kieran propped over him, savage and strange in his gentry clothes. The outline of Kieran's bandages pressed against Mark's chest, but otherwise Kieran's weight was a familiar one, to his body a welcome one. Kieran was looking down at him, silver and black eyes like the night sky.
"I love you," Kieran said, "and I have made promises. But if I am to be constantly shamed and sent away, I will not answer for my actions."
Mark smoothed back a lock of Kieran's hair. The strands slipped through his fingers, heavy silk.
"I'll make sure they treat you with more respect. They just have to get used to you."
Kieran's eyes glittered.
"I've done nothing to earn their distrust." "Oh, but you have," thought Mark. "You have, and everyone remembers it but you."
"They helped me rescue you," he said instead. "Don't be ungrateful." Kieran smiled at that. "I would rather imagine it was only you responsible." He bent down to nuzzle Mark's throat. Mark half-closed his eyes. He could feel his own lashes tickle his cheeks. He could feel the shift of weight of Kieran on top of him. Kieran smelled like ocean, as he usually did. Mark remembered a hill in a green country, a damp cairn of stones tumbling with Kieran to the bottom of it. Hands in his hair and on his body when he hadn't been touched in so long. He had burned and shivered. He shivered now. What was Kieran to him? What was he to Kieran? What had they ever been to each other?
"Kier," Mark said, "listen. Now is not the time for talking," said Kieran,
and his lips were feather light on Mark's skin, moving along the pulse of his throat, along his jaw to capture his mouth. It was a moment that felt stretched out to forever, a moment in which Mark fell through stars that shattered all around him. Kieran's lips were soft and cool and tasted like rain, and Mark clung to him in the dark and broken place at the bottom of the sky. He tangled his fingers in Kieran's hair, curled his fingertips in, heard Kieran exhale harshly against his mouth. His body pressed harder against Mark's, and then Kieran's fingers slid against the back of Mark's neck and knotted in the chain that held his elf bolt necklace. It was like being shaken awake. Mark rolled over, taking Kieran with him so they were lying side by side on the bed. The movement broke the kiss, and Kieran stared at him, half annoyed, half dazed.
"Miak," he said.
His voice took the word and turned it into a beckoning caress, an invitation to fairy pleasures unimaginable.
"No," said Mark, "don't call me that."
Kieran inhaled.
"There is something wrong between us, is there not? Mark, please tell me what it is. I sense the distance, but I do not understand its cause."
"You don't remember, but we had an argument about me staying with my family. That's why I gave you my elf bolt necklace back." Kieran looked bewildered.
"But I always knew you'd stay with your family. I did not want it, but I must have come to accept it."
I remember waking in the Unseelie Court. I do not remember feeling any anger toward you. It wasn't a bad fight, Mark swallowed. But I wasn't expecting this. You, in my world, all the complications of these politics. You don't want me here? Kieran's face didn't change, but his hair was suddenly streaked with white where it curled against his temples. It's not that, Mark said. In the Wild Hunt, I thought I might die any night, every night. I wanted everything, always, and risked anything because no one depended on me. And then there was you, and we depended on each other, but... He thought of Christina. Her words came to him, and he couldn't help using them, though it almost felt like a betrayal. Christina, who he had kissed with joyous abandon for those few moments near the revel, before he had realized what she thought of him. Someone she would only kiss when drunk or out of her mind. I have always needed you, Kieran, he said. I have needed you to live. I've always needed you so much. I never had a chance to think about whether we were good for each other or not. Kieran sat up. He was silent, though Mark saw, to his relief, that the white streaks of his hair had gone back to their more normal blue-black color. That is honest, he said finally. I cannot fault you there. Kieran, how much time do you need? Kieran had drawn himself up, and he was all proud prince of fairy now. Mark thought of the times he'd seen Kieran at revels, at a distance, seen the smaller fairies scatter in front of him, girls and boys who hung on his arms hoping for a word or a look because the favor of even a disgraced prince was currency. And Kieran, granting neither those words nor those looks, because his words and looks were all for Mark, all for what they had between them when the Wild Hunt was looking away. Maybe just a few days, Mark said. If you can be patient for that long. I can be patient for a few days. Why did you choose Christina, Mark said abruptly, when you had to swear fealty to one of us? Why her? Did you do it to unsettle me? Kieran grinned. Not everything is as they say about you, Mark. He leaned back. His hair was very black against the stark white linens. Shouldn't you be going? Don't you want me to stay here? Mark said. With you? Well, you weigh my merits as if I were a horse you are considering buying. No, Kieran said. Go back to your own room, Mark Blackthorn. And if loneliness keeps you from your rest, do not seek me out. Surely there must be a rune for sleeplessness. There wasn't, but Mark didn't feel like it would be a good idea to say so. Kieran's eyes were glittering dangerously. Mark left, wondering if he'd made a horrible mistake. Christina's room in the London Institute was much like the room she'd seen in pictures of other institutes all over the world, plainly furnished with a heavy bed, wardrobe, dresser, and desk. A small bathroom, clean, with a shower, that she'd already used. Now she lay on the lumpy mattress, the blankets pulled up to her chest, her arm aching. She wasn't sure why. She'd loved every moment of flying with the Wild Hunt. If she'd injured herself somehow, she had no memory of it. Not when she'd mounted the horse, or when they'd ridden, and surely she'd recall pain like that. And how could she have hurt herself in any other way? She rolled to the side and reached to touch her witch light on the nightstand table. It flared to a soft glow, illuminating the room, the enormous English bed, the heavy oak furniture. Someone had scrawled the initials JB plus LH into the paint by the window. She stared down at her right arm. Around her wrist was a band of paler skin, slightly reddened at the edges, like a scar left by a fiery bracelet. "You'll be all right," Diana said. It was half declaration, half question. Diana, Julian, and Emma stood in the entryway of the London Institute. The Institute doors were open, and the dark courtyard was visible. It had rained earlier, and the flagstones were washed clean. Julian could see the arch of the famous metal gate that closed off the Institute, and the words marked into it, "We are dust and shadows." "We'll be fine," Julian said. "Malcolm's dead, again. No one's trying to kill us," said Emma. It's practically a vacation. Diana hoisted her bag higher on her shoulder. Her plan was to take a taxi to Westminster Abbey, where a secret tunnel, accessible only to shadow hunters, led to Idris. I don't like leaving you. Julian was surprised. Diana had always come and gone according to her own lights. We'll be fine, he said. Evelyn's here, and the Clave is just a phone call away. Not a phone call you want to make, said Diana. I sent another message to Magnus and Alec, and I'll keep in touch with them from Alicante. She paused. If you need them, send a fire message and they'll come. I can handle this, Julian said. I've handled a lot worse for a lot longer. Diana's eyes met his. I would step in, if I could, she said. You know that. I'd take the Institute if it was possible. Put myself against the Dearborns. I know, Julian said. And oddly enough, he did. Even if he didn't know what prevented Diana from putting herself forward as a candidate, he knew it was something important. If it would make any difference, Diana said. But I wouldn't even get through the interview. It would be futile, and I wouldn't be able to stay with you or help you. She sounded as if she were trying to convince herself, and Emma reached her hand out, impulsive as always. Diana, you know we'd never let them take you away from us, she said. Emma, Julian's voice was sharper than he'd intended. The anger he'd been shoving down since Emma had said she and Mark had broken up was rising again, and he didn't know how long he could control it. Diana knows what she's talking about. Emma looked startled by the coldness of his tone. Diana flicked her eyes between them. Look, I know it's incredibly stressful, being kept from your home like this, but try not to fight, she said. You're going to have to hold everything together until I get back from Idris. It's only a day or two, said Emma, not looking at Julian, and nobody's fighting. Stay in touch with us, Julian said to Diana. Tell us what Gia says. She nodded. I haven't been back to Idris since the Dark War. It'll be interesting. She leaned forward and kissed first Jules and then Emma quickly on the cheek. Take care of yourselves. I mean it. She flipped the hood up on her jacket and stepped outside, swallowed up almost instantly by shadows. Emma's arm pressed briefly against Julian's as she raised her hand to wave goodbye. In the distance, Julian heard the clang of the front gate. Jules, she said without turning her head. I know you said Diana refused to take the Institute, but do you know why? No, he said. It was a single word, but there was venom in it. On the topic of confessions, were you planning on telling the rest of Mark's family why you dumped their brother with no warning? Emma looked astonished. You're angry that Mark and I broke up? I guess you've dumped two of their brothers, if we're really counting, he said, as if she hadn't spoken. Who's next? Ty? He knew immediately he'd gone too far. Ty was her little brother, just as he was Julian's. Her face went very still. Screw you, Julian Blackthorne, she said, spun on her heel and stalked back upstairs. Neither Julian nor Emma slept well that night, though each of them thought they were the only one troubled, and the other was probably resting just fine. I think it's time for you to get your first real mark, said Ty. Only the three of them, Livy, Ty, and Kit, were left in the parlor. Everyone else had gone to bed. Kit guessed from the quality of the darkness outside that it was probably 3 or 4 in the morning, but he wasn't tired. It could be the jet lag, or portal lag, or whatever they called it. It could be the contagious relief of the others that they were all reunited again. It could be the approximate 600 cups of tea. I've had marks, said Kit. You put that Arazi on me. Livy looked mildly curious but didn't ask. She was sprawled in an armchair by the fire, her legs hooked over one side. I meant a permanent one, said Ty. This is the first real one we all get. He held up his long-fingered right hand, the back of it toward Kit, showing him the graceful eye-shaped rune that identified all shadow hunters. Voyance. It clarifies sight. I can already see the shadow world, Kit pointed out. He took a bite out of the chocolate digestive biscuit, one of the few good foods England had to offer, in his opinion. You probably don't see everything you could, Livy said, and turned up her hands to indicate neutrality. But you do what you want. It's the most painful rune to get, said Ty, but worthwhile.
Sure, said Kit, idly picking up another biscuit.
Livy had sneaked a whole package from the pantry.
Sounds great.
He looked up in surprise.